The Teaching of the Master by Brother L.G. Sargent. Part 5, Chapter 2, The Lord of the Heart, Matthew 6, verse 24 and 25. No man can serve two masters, but either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. Ye cannot serve God and mammon. Therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what ye shall eat or what ye shall drink, nor yet for your body what ye shall put on. Is not the life more than the food, and the body than the raiment? In the first three Gospels, the verb to serve is applied to the relation between men and God only here and in Luke 16, verse 13, and in the latter, where a similar saying follows the parable of the unrighteous steward, it takes the form, no servant, household servant or steward, can serve two masters. The verb arises naturally from the parabolic figure of two masters, but as applied to the followers of God, it has a special fitness, for in Oriental life, sonship implied service, as in the parable of the two sons in Matthew 21, verse 28 to 30. Where life was mainly agricultural, it was natural for the sons to work under the father on the family farm. The more well-to-do, like the father in the parable of the prodigal son, would have three forms of service, that of their sons, the hired servants, and bondmen. So the elder son complains, lo, these many years do I serve thee, neither transgress I at any time thy commandment. And part of the sin of the prodigal was that by his departure he had deprived his father of his services. Strictly, however, the verb means to be a slave, to serve as a bondman. And the stricter meaning has its place in the saying in Matthew. A man might be employed as a hired servant by two masters, but he can be a bond slave only to one, for only one at a time can own him. What, then, is a man who treasures up earthly wealth? Is he not the master of his own resources, to do as he will with them? Does he not control the power which they bring? No, says Jesus. It is the riches who are the master, and he is the slave. He does not own them so much as they own him, because they have his heart. They have him altogether. By dominating his desires, they corrupt his spiritual vision, and as a blind man, he is at their mercy. And so, as a climax to the steps in thought in the preceding verses, Jesus now personifies riches as Mammon, the master. The term is well known in the Talmud and Targums, and usually occurs with some qualifying expression. The Mammon of wickedness, the mammon of falsehood, and so on. In the same way, Jesus speaks of the mammon of unrighteousness. Nowhere in Jewish literature, it seems, is mammon anything more than a personification, and nowhere is the personification so vivid as in the words of Jesus. In Matthew 6, verse 24, Mammon stands unmasked as a false god, for it is a psychological truth that covetousness is idolatry. It sets up an idol in the heart, and though, like Molech of old, the idol may be nothing in the world, yet, like Molech, through its power over the imagination, it claims its human sacrifices. In stark opposition, therefore, are God and Mammon, and like the Israelites on Mount Carmel, men must choose whom they will serve. They cannot really halt between two opinions. Know ye not that to whom ye yield yourselves bondslaves to obey, his bondslaves ye are to whom ye obey, whether of sin unto death, or of obedience unto righteousness? Jesus' teaching is uncompromising. There is no service of God but wholehearted service. And the man who thinks he can serve both God and the world a little deceives himself. Love and hate may not have here the emotional force which we commonly attach to them. Even in Deuteronomy 22, verses 15 to 17, they mean to prefer and to slight, or be indifferent to. Strong preferences described by Hebrew idiom in these sharply antithetic terms. But however we understand them, we must not weaken the antithesis. A man is confronted by a moral choice. He must choose by an act of will, and as he chooses, so he must live. If he does not choose God, he has, by that fact, entered the service of God's enemy. It is one of the remarkable facts about Jesus that he himself demands no lesser loyalty from those who would follow him. To the man who wanted to defer a response indefinitely by pleading home ties, he says, "Follow me and leave the dead to bury their dead." Warning the disciples of the family divisions his message would cause, and of the conflict of loyalties which would result, he says, "He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he that doth not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me." He makes on men the same decisive demands as God. And the apostles, his brothers James and Jude included, can fittingly call themselves bond slaves of Christ. For he too is the master. It is as the bond slave of Christ, his vision sharpened by service, that James reflects this irreconcilable antagonism between God and mammon, when he says, "The friendship of the world is enmity with God," and draws the conclusion from it in concrete terms. "Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God." The connection is closer than appears in brief quotation. James has been contrasting envying and strife with the wisdom which is from above, and traces the source of envy to a desire for possession. The motive of that desire is that men may consume the possession upon their pleasures. The context shows that by pleasures, James does not mean only social pleasure or entertainment, though these are not excluded. His thought includes all the gratification of human passions, which wealth gives the power to indulge. And they may be nonetheless pleasures, even if many of them are, like envy, very near to pain. The world which the men whom he describes are allied is the sphere of the passions of men, whose minds dwell solely in the material and visible order. And the prince of that world is Mammon. Mammon does not stand only for hoarded wealth. His service includes all anxious striving for material things, and the poor whose minds are consumed with their poverty may be as much his slaves as the rich who scheme to be richer. Neither can have their hearts in earth and heaven at the same time. In nothing is human nature more prone to lose the end in the means than in the preoccupation with bodily needs. How many people kill themselves with worrying whether they will have enough to live on? How many more make life a burden for the same cause, and so deprive it of any value? In moments of detachment, we can see this strange self-stultification by which men destroy a thing in the very act of agonizing to preserve it. and we recognize it as the most poignant example of that emptiness and striving after wind, which the preacher found to be characteristic of human life. Yet at the same time, and in some measure, we all fall into the fallacy. This much is discernible to reasoning, which does not rise above the level of the earth. But when Jesus says the life is more than the food which sustains it, he carries us to an altogether higher realm. He has implicitly brought God into the comparison. Who gave the life? Who formed the body? If we could not produce these for ourselves, why should we think it depends solely on us to provide the food and clothing which they need? If God has given the greater gift, will he not give the lesser? Take no thought, says the Authorized Version, in the language of the 17th century, in which Francis Bacon could say that a man died with thought and anguish. The sense of anxiety and often of despondency is prominent in the usage of the time, and was doubtless present to the mind of the translators. Is this the meaning of the original? Nearly all modern versions give anxious care or some equivalent, not because the word used necessarily has this meaning, but because it is the meaning which is deemed to fit the context and to be justified by general biblical usage. While this removes a possible misunderstanding, we must beware of limiting the idea unduly to mere fret. While the Lord does not forbid honest provision, he certainly forbids all preoccupation with bodily needs, whether the mood be anxious or assertive. As to biblical usage, whatever the classical force of the term, both its noun and verb are found in the Septuagint in contexts which indicate care, anxiety, distress, as the prevailing, though not the exclusive, sense. So too in the New Testament. Though the sense of a godly care for one another's welfare is sometimes found. In the Lord's exposition of the parable of the sower, where he speaks of the cares of this world and riches and desires, he is thinking of the consuming concern which chokes the germinating word of the gospel. Particularly interesting is Peter's casting all your care upon him, because he is quoting the Septuagint of Psalm 55, verse 22, cast thy burden on the Lord. This act of confident trust is in Peter's mind the sequel to humbling yourselves under the mighty hand of God. It is the product of a childlike humility, whereas the effort to carry the burden ourselves is the expression of human pride. In such association of ideas, do we not catch an unmistakable echo of the chief shepherd of whom Peter has been writing? And are we not justified in taking this as a guide to the meaning of the word in the Lord's use? Take no thought, may then be understood as, do not burden yourself with care for your life. Do not try to carry the burden that is not yours, but have peace of mind. The thought is common to Jesus and to Peter that those who are the object of God's guarding care have no need to carry a load of anxiety. He careth for you, says Peter, using a different word, which means he makes you the object of his interest. And in so saying, he's drawing out in plain prose the thought which is poetically implied in the sermon. While then mere human shrewdness can see the folly of ruining life in the effort to maintain it, Jesus sees men under the shadowing arm of God. He speaks with the sublime assurance of one to whom creation is not a remote theory of man's origin, but an ever-present fact. God created man, and what he created will be the object of his continuing concern. Moreover, the disciples to whom Jesus is speaking are chosen and called for the fuller life of the kingdom of God. They are to be the subjects of a new creation. God, therefore, is not only their source and origin, he surrounds them. He is their constant environment. They are in him. And from this, Jesus draws one conclusion, which for him is self-evident. The daily life that is lived in God is not life without labour or without forethought, but it is emphatically life without care.